The history of the solar system is written in stone, but not in any script you'll find on Earth stones. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Each meteorite has its own history, recorded in its chemistry and microstructure. The oldest, most primitive ones contain material from the very beginning of the solar system, when solid materials first condensed from the protoplanetary disk. In fact, two types of tiny components of so-called chondrites share such a distinction: irregular-shaped calcium-aluminum-rich inclusions, and round mineral particles called chondrules, after which this class of meteorites is named. Their composition and form reveal a great deal about the process and the environment of their formation, but that story is surprisingly complex. Dr. Emmanuel Jacquet is working to piece together the 4.5 billion-year-old puzzle these chondrites tell. A postdoctoral fellow at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics, he tackles the problem from both sides. First, the fine details of microstructure and chemistry of these materials, and what it tells us about how they formed. And second, theoretical modeling of protoplanetary disks, studying processes that could create the conditions necessary to form them. I spoke to Dr. Jacquet recently about chondrites and what they reveal about how planetary systems are born. So welcome to the program, Dr. Jacquet. And I guess you're working in materials and dynamics, things that we find out in the solar system right from the start. I guess my first question is just for some basic understanding of the nature of these kinds of materials. What are chondrites to begin with?
Well, chondrites are the class which comprise the majority of meteorites. So meteorites are debris from asteroids, which are building blocks of planets which did not agglomerate to form a planet 4.5 billion years ago. And chondrites have this peculiarity among meteorites that are very primitive. They did not change since they were agglomerated 4.5 billion years ago. And therefore, chondrites are the fossils of the early solar system.
Okay. How is it that we know that they haven't been modified?
They have a very delicate structure. They have different components which could not have survived if these meteorites had been heated to high temperatures for a long time. And for example, they are a subequal amount of fun. They contain a substantial proportion of metal, and had they been melted like the Earth has been, the metal would have segregated and formed a core. So they are primitive material.
Okay. What does a chondrite look like compared to another meteorite? What is this composition?
A chondrite is dominated by silicate spherules, which are about a millimeter in diameter, which are called chondrules. So they are very distinct objects, and they also, besides chondrules, they also contain metal grains, which are disseminated in the meteorite. They may also contain, but more rarely, what we call refractory inclusions, which are white irregular objects, which are the oldest solids of the solar system.
Okay, so it's not just a piece of rock, there's these little spherules embedded in them.
Yes, you must think of chondrites as cosmic sediment, basically in a conglomerate of various solids that are native to the protoplanetary disks that were agglomerated more or less by chance together.
And they just kind of accumulated together and formed a solid mass.
Yes, over the years they were lithified as a coherent rock, but originally it was a very loose agglomerate of objects.
Okay. And so these chondrules, what are they like?
Chondrules are solidified droplets. They are heated at high temperatures, they have been melted, and then they cooled and solidified. And the presence of glass tells you that they solidified quite rapidly, say at scale of hours or days.
So as opposed to perhaps many millions of years in some way.
Exactly. So the formation of chondrules were very temporally and also spatially localized events in the early solar system.
Okay.
And we don't know what the nature of these events was.
So these same chondrites, the same meteorites which contain the chondrules, also contain, you say, these refractory metal inclusions?
These refractory inclusions. Mm-hmm. They contain some metal, but, yeah. Not, but they are dominated by by more rocky material. So they are rich, these refractory inclusions are enriched in calcium and aluminum in particular. Mm-hmm. So these refractory inclusions have been dated to be the very old, the very first solids of the solar system. They are 5,568,000,000 years old. And they are presumed to have formed by direct condensation, like snowflakes, but at very high temperature, at 2000 degrees Kelvin. And they are basically the first solids to condense when you cool down a hot gas of solar composition.
And that's a very precise age that you gave me. Do they all have that same age?
The primitive one, yes. For the time being, they, within, say, 100,000 years, they're the same time zero of the solar system. Okay. So it seems.
So that's basically the point in the formation of the solar system at which the very first material started to solidify.
The very first material native to the protoplanetary disk, because we also know that chondrites contain some amount, which is still not yet well quantified, of pre-solar material that has not been processed by the formation of the solar system itself, and which therefore represent pristine pre-solar grains synthesized in other stars. Because what we must understand is that all the matter we have now today was first produced in stars which existed before the birth of the Sun. And this material has simply been processed in the disk, part of which has been vaporized and then recondensed, but some of which has survived also in pristine form.
Embedded in those chondrites?
They are embedded in as fine grains between the chondrules and the refractory inclusions and the metal. Okay. You find some of these grains, very small.
So here we are at this age when the first native materials are starting to condense. What's the environment around them in which they're condensing? What's that pre-protoplanetary environment like?
The protoplanetary disk is a disk of gas and dust. The gas is dominant over the dust. Dust makes up only 1% of the mass. The gas is predominantly hydrogen. This disk is optically thick in the sense that if you are inside the disk, you don't see the sun, although it shines a bit already. And this disk is relatively turbulent. There are turbulent motions which are slow at our scale, but which are sufficient to produce some heat and to generate high temperature, like 1,000, maybe 2,000 degrees, relatively close to the sun, at distance comparable to that of the Earth to the sun, for example. And such high temperatures were conducive to the formation of these refractory inclusions at that time.
Okay. And you say it's optically thick, but should I think of it as dense in a way comparable to the Earth's atmosphere, or?
Oh, it's much less dense than that. We don't exactly know what the density of the protoplanetary disk was. A useful benchmark, which is called the minimum Magellan nebula, states that at the distance of the Earth, the density was something like 10 to the minus 6 kilogram per cubic meter, which is much, much smaller, at least 6 orders of magnitude smaller than the density of the Earth.
And so at some point in that, then, we start seeing temperatures that allow these refractory materials to solidify.
Yes, so shortly afterward, because this temperature did not last very long.
Oh, okay. So what's bringing that temperature profile? Is it just that the sun is cooling, or what's going on?
It's not the sun. Again, the temperature was produced by turbulence.
Okay.
What happens is that over the years, the matter of the disk is slowly flowing toward the sun. So the disk is becoming less dense, and therefore is less able to trap the heat liberated by turbulence. And therefore, the temperature goes down.
Okay.
Just because the gas density is decreasing.
And sometime soon thereafter, we start seeing the chondrules forming themselves.
Yes, so probably the precursor of chondrules, that is to say the material that was melted to produce the chondrules, was formed contemporaneously with the refractory inclusions. Mm-hmm. But the melting events that produced their characteristic round shape, these melting events occurred repeatedly, apparently, over a range of a few million years after the time zero defined by the CAIs, refractory inclusions.
Okay. And we know this because the chondrules have different ages, or...?
Exactly, because of the age of chondrules.
Okay.
And also sometimes we see relics of old chondrules embedded in new chondrules. So we know that there had to be different generations of chondrules.
Oh, so they may be processed more than once.
Exactly.
Okay. What kind of events might produce that kind of melting? The processing, heating, and resolidification of those droplets?
That's still a very mysterious area of research. It's a very important mystery, but it's a mystery not because of a shortage of hypotheses. So several hypotheses have been proposed. For example, people propose that shock waves may have occurred in the disk, and shock waves can eat up material when they pass through it. Shock waves may have been produced, for example, by planetary embryos, which would be an eccentric orbit, and which therefore would be moving supersonically with respect to the gas. More or less in the same way, you can imagine a supersonic plane on Earth produce a bow shock. So that's one possibility to create chondrules. But other scenarios have been envisioned as well. People envisioned different kinds of energetic impacts between planetesimals, with splash droplets could be chondrules, etc. But for the time being, it's still a very obscure area, because you can imagine very solid objections against any of the models which have been proposed thus far. However, the abundance of chondrules in primitive meteorites, which are the chondrites, which are named after chondrules, indicate that whichever process produced chondrules was an important process in the protoplanetary disk. So it has to be something quite standard.
But that seems to have had a short period of time in which it was important.
Not very short, because from the observation of protoplanetary disk outside our solar system, we infer that typical disk lifetime is only a few million years. The median disk lifetime is 3 million years. And the chondrules as we date them indicate a time span of a few million years. So it really was a process intrinsic to the protoplanetary disk.
Okay, so as long as there's a protoplanetary disk, perhaps there are chondrules forming that whole time.
Yes, roughly.
Yeah. Okay, and where does the disk go?
Well, most of the matter of the disk flowed into the sun. The sun was continuously fed by material falling in during the whole lifetime of the protoplanetary disk. So because of turbulence, the matter was spiraling inward in the disk and gradually going into the sun. And the remainder of the gas the gas which was not bottled up, so to speak, into the giant planets, the remainder of the gas was presumably photoevaporated at the very end of the disk lifetime by the sun's radiation.
With the sun itself. And these chondrules and the chondrites that they incorporated into seem to have escaped both that process and the process of planet formation.
They are trapped in the process of planet formation, because obviously chondrites come from asteroids, which is one stage of the planet formation, because terrestrial planets formed by the coagulation of asteroid-sized bodies. So what happened for the asteroids we know today between Mars and Jupiter is that Jupiter, because of its gravity, forbade the formation of a terrestrial-sized planet between Mars and Jupiter. And therefore, you have this remaining, I could say, rubble of building blocks of planets, which is now known as the asteroid main belt.
So if it hadn't been for Jupiter's strong gravity, we might have another planet there. And we
exactly.
Might not have chondrites falling into us.
It would be more and more difficult.
Yeah. So of all the meteorites which fall to Earth, how many of them are chondrites?
I think 85%. It's really the majority.
Oh, okay. They're that numerous.
Yes. Although many chondrites have been somehow eaten a bit, so they are not as primitive as they could be.
Is there some diversity among those chondrites? Are they all the same?
There is some diversity. I spoke about the various components of chondrites, so the chondrules, small spherules, the refractory inclusions, and also the fine-grained dust, which is cementing all these. These components do not occur in the same proportions in all chondrites, for example. You have chondrites which are rich in chondrules, you have chondrites which are rich in refractory inclusions. So there is a whole diversity of chondrites, actually. And we don't know, at that point, what this diversity means. The very problem with meteorites is that they are rocks without geological context. When we find a meteorite on Earth, we don't know where it formed, and a fortiori, we don't know when it accreted. So we don't know how to interpret this diversity of primitive meteorites. We don't know whether they represent different epochs of the protoplanetary disk, or whether they represent different distance of formation to the sun. We don't know that.
Are there any details that we can get about that environment beyond what we've already said, what this variation can tell us?
Well, for the time being, we are reduced to conjecture. One relatively solid thing to say, nonetheless, is that comparisons have been made between the reflected light of asteroids and meteorites, and they seem to suggest that asteroids that look like the most primitive of the primitive meteorites, so to speak, which are called the Carinthius chondrites, which are enriched in the refractory inclusion. This asteroid seems to be more prevalent in the outer regions of the main belt, whereas asteroids related to less primitive meteorites are more prevalent in the inner belt. But it is quite questionable that it is only a question of heliocentric distance, because it is difficult to understand why meteorites which form far from the sun should be enriched in these refractory inclusions, for example, because refractory inclusions must have formed close to the sun, because they required high temperature to form. And what is more, over the passage of time, these refractory inclusions should have drifted towards the sun. So it is difficult to understand that only in terms of heliocentric distance. I personally have studied the problem of the aerodynamic redistribution of chondrite components in the disk. And to resolve this paradox, I would propose that carbonaceous chondrites formed earlier than non-carbonaceous chondrites, so that they had a higher amount of refractory inclusions, for example. There are other arguments as well. And the fact that the parent bodies of non-carbonaceous chondrites seems to be located closer to the sun than those of carbonaceous chondrites could be due to the very drift effect I've mentioned of solids towards the sun. That is to say, if non-carbonaceous chondrites formed later, then the material out of which they formed would have been located closer to the sun, and this would explain what we see currently in the main belt.
There's at least the hint of a kind of complex story of movement and redistribution and recombination.
The different components in chondrites have fairly different ages. You have the refractory inclusions, and then you have the chondrules, which form over a range of a few million years after refractory inclusion. This is something that you see at the scale of single meteorites. So this indicates that these components spent a long amount of time as free-floating objects in the disk before being agglomerated as the rocks we know today. So there was plenty of time for significant redistribution of material to occur in the solar system.
Okay. What are the next puzzles that we need to solve in this question? Where can we look next to try and further constrain this story?
One first thing, of course, is to continue to look at the problem of chondrules. So I also conduct a trace element analysis of chondrules to try to constrain their thermal history, because obviously if you don't understand the formation of chondrules, it will be difficult to say we really understand anything about chondrites. And I also continue to study the aerodynamics of chondrite components in the disk to try to see whether, more quantitatively, whether they can account for the different compositions, the different Burr compositions we see, chemical composition we see in chondrites in general.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you for talking to us, and good luck trying to piece together this very complicated puzzle.
Thank you.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
It's interesting to me that at the same time as these chondrules and the meteorites that contain them are some of the oldest materials in the solar system, at the same time as we have this expression of great age, it's also one of the oldest open problems in meteorite studies. We don't know exactly how they form or where they come from and how this whole process worked. And it's interesting to me that both of them are kind of still outstanding and getting old.
Well, that's why some of the people are still getting paid, because they had to study those, right?
That's true, yeah. It's good to have problems to work on.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, we do have samples here with us where we can look at these chondrules, and I know like a lot of people here at Western even study those. They analyze them to see what are made up of, theorize how they would have formed. But they are very interesting, especially like when you look them under the microscope. Mm-hmm. And some of the students actually showed one of the electron microscope pictures, I don't know, from some class. They were really interesting to see. And like, obviously, the theory behind them, as Raymond said, we still don't know how they formed. I mean, there are things they think the situation was when they formed, but we still don't have the concrete evidence that that's how they were formed.
And why look into those rocks? You look into the past of our solar system, even before the Earth and all the planets, gas giants.
Yeah, before basically everything. And these objects contain the oldest solid materials in the solar system.
Yeah.
We learned that this age is actually really well known. They're able to construct, mm-hmm. which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Precisely, too.
Yeah. What was it? 4, 5, 6, 8 times 10 to the 6?
Yeah.
I'm told this is a very important number to memorize.
To understand how these planets formed, basically you need the building blocks for it. And these actually make the basis of the building block of our planet. And to get the whole process of how we went from being a cloud to being a planet,
yeah.
earthy planet, a rocky planet, you need those small pieces. And even though they are the oldest pieces, they are still puzzles.
Yeah.
Hence, connecting the dots between the two is very hard.
Yeah, and those dots are in totally different domains, right? They're in, you have to do modeling of the dynamics of debris disks, and you have to do chemistry and physics and some geology. We get rocks falling out of the sky and we try and trace where they came from to try and map the solar system. Where do these different materials reside? Inferences about how they would evolve over all these billions of years. A large number of pieces and a long chain of reasoning that goes into trying to put this story together. It's really impressive. And, you know, it can seem kind of tenuously connected evidence, but we have the evidence for sure. You know, these chondrules are found in all the chondrites, which are the most common of the meteorites. So they're falling out of the sky all the time. So it's real. And just understanding exactly how it fits in requires this tremendous breadth of knowledge. And so no wonder we haven't solved it after something like two centuries of looking at rocks.
I mean, I wish we would have one or two samples from an extrasolar planetary system to see and compare, you know, if it's really the same process that went on here is actually even going on in other places. I mean, we have seen things like comets and asteroids in the debris disks, but we obviously don't have a sample in our hand, which is from another solar system, which basically has the same kind of chondrites, the same kind of meteorites that actually we have here.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, so we've seen debris disks, right? You can see them around other stars. And so the question is, are they all basically the same? Because the physics is pretty similar, right? Physics is the same everywhere. Are they all the same, or are they as different from each other as all the planets are from each other? We've seen all kinds of weird and bizarre planets, even in this solar system, let alone all those thousands of exoplanets.
Yeah.
So are the disks all the same? Are they all different?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that would go into making a solar system, whether it's for our solar system or it's for some other one, because basically depends, A, where it's being formed, how much material it has from its environment to condense into these rocky objects. Obviously, what kind of star it is going around. I mean, imagining a rocky planet around a giant star would be weird, right? Because obviously it's way hotter compared to our sun. And then obviously the material that's being condensed, how large the disk is, that would even make a lot of difference on what kind of planets you would find.
Yeah, what is the composition of the disk and the star? And what's the dynamics? Does that depend on the size? Or, I mean, is there some kind of like scale size of turbulence in there? Dr. Jacquet kind of talks about proportionality of trying to model turbulence in that disk. He was talking afterwards, I spoke to him a little bit, saying that magnetohydrodynamics is an important part of it. It's not just gravity. You have to deal with magnetic fields between all these
places. Yeah, that is also a very important point, is that the fact that some stars have very, very strong magnetic fields, while others, you don't see any magnetic fields. So obviously, the fact that you have a magnetic field would make a hell lot of difference on how you get the composition, or even the spaced out way of where you get rocky planets or where you get gaseous planets. Because basically, if you're looking at chondrules, which are basically formed when they're heated up and then quickly solidify because they're in the cooler environment. If you have magnetic fields, then it's very easy to get these jets where you can basically throw them out up in almost perpendicular to the disk, and basically they fall down onto the disk, which is way more cooler than the star. You would easily get these chondrules, but would you be able to see these in stars which actually don't have magnetic fields? And there are stars which actually don't have large magnetic fields like our sun. So it's very interesting to see if that would make any difference, you know?
Yeah, the magnetic field of stars as opposed to what's going on just within the disk. And, you know, you propose jets, and Dr. Jacquet talks about these shock waves as planetesimals pass through disks and things, impacts happen.
Yeah.
So huge energetic events that are not real steady state easy things to model.
Yeah.
It's got to be difficult to understand and guess what's going on in that.
I mean, it's very hard to, like, we have seen these jets. We have seen even just shockwaves from those jets disturbing other stars with disks around them.
Oh, really?
Can also be one of the reasons. Yeah, they have actually seen those.
So basically, disks are interacting with each other.
Well, not actually interacting. The fact that, okay, if one of the star has its jet pointed towards the debris disks of another star, and it throws out, you know, high velocity jet, this material in the other disk gets perturbed.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and then this material, you never know how maybe this high velocity jet was too hot, disturbing, you know, all the material mm-hmm. in the other disk, creating some kind of shockwave. And
how long do the consequences of that persist in the formation of that star system?
Yeah, I mean, it depends, you know. Yeah. Like, and obviously we don't have a sample to measure that how long ago or how much in the past this happened. But, I mean, we have seen things like this happening right now in the universe. So, I mean, there are lots of theories on how these can be formed. It's just we haven't proved any of them work.
So never mind Mars sample return. You want us to have an actual extra solar sample return.
Though that's going to take a couple hundred years,
I don't know.
It's going
to take a long time, yeah.
Well, we probably need a better technology for that.
I think we do, yeah.
That's our show for this week. Western World is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western World was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshdi Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshdi Patel, Raymond Francis, and Zengi Hu. Our editor was Parshdi Patel and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can once again make world enough in time to join us next week, right here on astronomy.fm.